When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I'm talking with Dr. Mark Shapiro on resilience and teamwork during this COVID-19 pandemic. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Hey, Dennis, it's going well. Thank you for inviting me back.
I think kind of the way I was looking at it is, you know, at least for the most part, I think, you know, the civilian medical system, like things like resiliency isn't really built into it because they don't have like a selection process for high stress situations. I don't think anyway. Versus, you know, the military and special operations, you're just hammered until they figure out, can he stand it or not? But I don't think that they have that on the medical side, in the civilian world anyway. So how do you deal with people of the entire spectrum, I'm sure, of people who are just, you know, hardened like a diamond, and you have all these, you know, fuzzy bunnies on the other side of the spectrum? How do you get everybody through something like this, you know?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, Dennis, because I'm seeing the same thing. And I'm wondering what my experience would have been if I didn't have this special relationship with, you know, special operations and working with the good folks at Ragged Edge, for instance, and actually developing the medical proficiency training at the institutions I've been, meaning I've been exposed to elements of their training and found it fascinating, and actually have used some of the principles in selection in working with the residents. A couple hours or an entire morning isn't going to provide that type of insight or that type of training, but it does expose the residents to why resilience is important. So in the civilian world, developing a classroom or a wet lab to identify stress and how to deal with it and what kind of stresses they may encounter might go against the ACGME, which is the governing body for training, meaning that this is not something developed by PhDs and we don't get consent. And, you know, it's potentially stressful for these trainees, and that could provide exposure to myself for exposing trainees to stresses that they wouldn't normally encounter. So I have to be very careful so that I am not, you know, legally bound to go through some type of formal consent. Mm-hmm. And so things that I've done are to make them make some moral and ethical choices under some stressful situations, doing puzzles and so forth, and developing communication under timed events. And some of these events are mildly physical. There's no shouting, there's no name calling or anything like that. Nothing like that could happen in the civilian world without severe penalty. And so it's parallel maybe to some of the duress that you may experience in selection and so forth. But again, in the end, it's going to last. And in the end, they know that the instructors are not allowed to hurt their feelings or anything like that, because then there's retaliation and so on and so forth. What I have found is that some of these trainees, though, handle this type of duress exceedingly well. And in fact, some of them enjoy it and appreciate it and have written to their program director saying, we need more of these things. So although you can teach resilience, and there's books and classes and courses on teaching resilience, that is not part of the curriculum for anybody that I've ever seen in the civilian world. It certainly wasn't for me. It wasn't for my trainees at any of the academic institutions, you know, public or private, that I've been at. And that's unfortunate, because at least in surgery, and definitely in trauma surgery, you encounter very, very stressful situations, and how you deal with those, I have seen the gamut of responses, both in attendings and residents. So, you know, I think it's very, very important to identify these people and the people that don't have that resilience, to either teach them, allow them, guide them, or direct them into either some type of training, or maybe they would do better in a different profession.
Right. I mean, and the only way to find out is to put somebody to the test.
That's what I think. My guess is, in today's day and age, you know, I would suspect that you'd have to get consent and all kinds of things prior to doing something like that, because we're just in that age where, you know, you're subject to all kinds of risk, meaning litigation, meaning, you know, career right. changing
yeah.
appointments and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
Right. I mean, and obviously I've never been, I mean, I'm not a real doctor, nor ever claim to be, but, you know, I imagine there's many situations, whether the ER, the ICU, the surgery suite, you know, you have very stressful situations, split-second decision-making with, you know, fatal consequences for somebody. And that's kind of a routine, or a fairly routine thing. It's not an uncommon thing to have happen in those situations. But I think what is different between maybe those situations is that they're probably somewhat short-lived. Like, the situation happens, you made a decision, either good or bad, and whatever the outcome was, you know, will be sorted out in a few hours, right? Or less.
Well, perhaps let me share with you a couple of examples as to where I think either resilience or some type of stress inoculation or the ability to deal with stressful situations has made a difference. Mm-hmm. And I can share with you kind of on both ends. Many surgeons, certainly not all of them, but many surgeons feel most comfortable in the operating room. You've got nurses, techs, of various skill levels, but by and large, they may know the conduct of the trauma and operation to ensue. They may not, but regardless, they generally know the instruments, and they can expect certain types of language, hand signals, things like that, that will allow a good operation to happen. And and they're used to kind of short-curt answers and stuff like that. And they won't always argue with the surgeon what to do. There certainly are, nurses and residents, trainees and so forth, which will push back what the what goes on in an operating room, and what's needed and so on and so forth. And that also involves a fair amount of stress, but it's a lot easier for the surgeon to make these decisions in an operating room versus the emergency room, where it can, feel like a very austere environment. They certainly don't have the support that you do in the emergency department as you would in the operating room. Mm-hmm. And some big trauma centers can convert a ER to an operating room, and that certainly facilitates the care of these patients. But in the end, I would agree with you, there's the human element, and that human element can turn a very chaotic resuscitation into a much more calm one. Now, where it gets important to make the classification of stressful or not, again, is the experience and the situational awareness of the person conducting that resuscitation, whether it goes to an operation or not. And what I've seen in the past is that those who are stressed and have challenges dealing with that may make those patients or may declare those patients either expectant, non-operative, or choose to consult other subspecialties to take over. Mm. And those other subspecialties may not even be close, and that will ultimately lead to, may ultimately lead to the patient's demise.
Right.
So I've seen that in the civilian world. They'll see a bloody gunshot, or they'll see something that there's a lot of blood loss, and that looks very traumatic. That looks very lethal, but it's just blood loss. And the operation required to treat that can actually be handled quite simply. Whether it's a laparotomy, whether it's a tourniquet and a vascular repair, all of these things are, these scenarios have played out in the civilian theater. Mm-hmm. Now, in the military training, I've also been exposed to the trauma surgeon, if you will, but I think that's a really hot topic right now. A trauma surgeon is just kind of almost a colloquialism, because some of these trauma surgeons are, they may be vascular surgeons, urologists, gynecologists, playing the role of trauma surgeon in the military, and they may not be best suited. And these patients, surgeons may quickly declare that these patients are unsurvivable, and they may blame it on resource limitations. They may make these declarations very early without affording their patients at least some type of exploration and resuscitation and further evaluation. Mm. So I think the stress of the trauma and the lack of experience of the surgeon has led to arguably more patients being declared unsurvivable, and so that's a very long-winded answer as to why desensitization or learning how to deal with, becoming resilient, learning how to become resilient is super important.
Right. So, I mean, and as you know, with present day, we're going through COVID-19, the pandemic, and it's not just a single patient that's difficult and you're having to make very important decisions and reactions to. It's a endless wave of patients who are swamping our medical systems. Before another situation like that happens, or a natural disaster, or what have you, how do we on the civilian side and the military side, especially special operations side, we've kind of figured it out. We're just going to hit you over the head until we figure out, can you handle the stress or can you not? But how on the civilian side can you expose, you know, these are young residents, young nurses, you know, I guess learners in the medical field, you know, how can you integrate this stress inoculation into the educational system while still running that line of, conduct in the civilian medical side?
I don't know the answer to that, Dennis, but I can share with you what I do, and it seems to work well. Mm-hmm. And I do a couple of things. And again, this is all borrowed from chapters from your life and your training. So, yes, there are patients with COVID-19 who I talk about inoculation, no pun intended, but I've been in the midst of that in a hospital in New Jersey. And at least initially when COVID-19 was ramping up, there were a tremendous amount of deaths and hospitalizations and codes all night and rapid response team activations. And I think it's trying to get to know your team. Mm-hmm. And having that situational awareness where after one or two resuscitations, you're taking account of who's there and how they're reacting. Some people are good at compartmentalization. Some people are not. Some people weep. And some people get angry and frustrated. So after every death, I had a pause. I wanted to make sure that our team, and the team being residents, nurses, respiratory therapists, all the people that respond to these codes, understand that there's something to learn from every patient. No death should be taken in vain. No death is just a curiosity or a simple event. We need to think about it. So we pause, we reflect. Some people can pray, some people can just think. And once that, 30 to 45 seconds are over, we clean up and we meet and have a debriefing. And we discuss what elements of it went well, what elements didn't go well. Almost at all of these activations, there's a senior nurse there. And I communicate with that senior nurse. And some of these codes end very quickly in asystole, and some of them, we reach futility in a matter of, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, and those get called. And I ask the nurse to take account of her team, the nurses and techs, to get back with me, give me feedback, because some of these patients are family members of the nurses and physicians, and some of them are just friends, some people they've worked with for, months to years. And if we call it, if the sense is we're calling these things too short, or we don't give them our best shot, or we go beyond that and go into heroic measures where maybe we shouldn't be working so hard on these folks and letting them pass with some dignity. So I work with the leadership to get that feedback so that I'm not pushing the limits of the team, so that at the next code, the next day, we're all working together. They're not crumbling. Mm-hmm. So right or wrong, I think there is a constant tabulation, if you will, or accounting. Right. Of where the team is.
Okay.
And to give them an outlet, everybody grieves differently. And everybody's allowed to grieve in their own way, but we can't have disruptive grievement. And so I've had to, you know, take some people aside and just kind of listen to them. And whether it's tearful or they're angry or they wish a code ran differently, they're all allowed to have their say.
Right. Yeah, I think that's very helpful. Just from my experience on the teams, you know, there's definitely a rank structure, but that can be a little fluid at times, if you know what I mean. Depending on what went wrong, it's the team. And yes, there is a leader of the team, but sometimes, you know, leaders can make mistakes too, especially on the officer side. And
I think there's an important point for your listeners that, and my guess is this is more preaching to the choir because they're your listeners. But one of the things that I've encountered going to a completely different hospital and environment is that the selection of the intensivists is a little lax because it is a crisis. And talk about hurting a team dynamic and not having that situational awareness. There are some surgeons from some very high-profile places that are acting as intensivists that are really struggling with the lack of resources, both human and hardware, software, you know, drugs, machines, and so forth. And they expect to be delivering, you know, high-quality care as they would at some of these again, high profile institutions, and they're really the wrong person to have at these places or any crisis because either they're, you know, used to consulting people who do things that they don't do, or they're not used to the type of adversity that everybody's facing when you run out of, you know, common resuscitative medications, pressors, and so forth, and right. Adapting is not part of their repertoire, if you will. So I think, you know, we could also do a better job of having that type of selection because it just destroys a team.
Of course.
When I come in and hear that they, you know, everybody's afraid of working with Dr. So-and-so, or they've had enough of doctors, you know, they find it hard to function, and that's, you know, demoralizing. So again, the selection process that you guys go through is so important.
Right.
Oh, that we don't, the civilian side just doesn't see.
Right. I think that they look as an individual achievements more than as a team. I mean, I'm just guessing, but that's like where I would see things like that happening, is looking at an individual versus how do they integrate into a team.
Yeah.
But I mean, during a pandemic like this, I mean, you're getting people from everywhere just to fill positions, you know, where you
have. You are, and the interesting thing is some people are attracted to the reimbursement, the monetary side of it. And again, probably the wrong type of person you want. You know, I don't, my understanding is that, you know, an E7 is an E7, an E6 is an E6. And, you know, you may get some hazard pay, but I don't know anybody that signs up to work in special operations does that for a pay increase. and so some people are saying yes they can and yes they do, and they may look either, you know, have a nice pedigree or look good on paper or have a certificate, but this is not the time to sign up if you're not prepared for working in such, I'll say, asymmetric conditions. You know, you've got ICU nurses that are used to having one or two patients at most, and now they're caring for four or five. And you've got floor nurses who know nothing about managing pressors and so forth. And yet the step down units and the PACU and the ED is now turned into an ICU because they're taking care of critically ill patients on the ventilator. And these, there's no place to transfer them to. All the hospitals are full, and you either let them die or you give it your best shot. And the, some of these nurses are truly heroes because they're working above and beyond some of their scopes, and they're really being pushed hard.
Right. So, I mean, I imagine within, I guess, within a team, you know, I'm, let's say in, working in the ICU wherever you're working, within a team, you have both experienced and non-experienced ICU nurses. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think that's.
And so that's, I think that way you can kind of spread the experience out a little bit farther, augment the numbers with somebody who's less experienced, either because they're in a step down or in a med surge unit, or they're brand new. And that way you have more of the experienced people being able to educate and train and overwatch the lesser experienced. Is that what's happening?
That's happening to some degree. I worked with a nurse the other night who had no experience. And she was hurting, she was crumbling, and I'll be honest with you, this is, I'm learning. And I've had to change my speed, and I've had to correct or alter or modify some of my expectations in the way I work with these folks. And you know, there's a lot to say about positive reinforcement.
Right.
This nurse who was giving me everything she had, and she really didn't have the, she didn't have much, but she's a good person. She tried everything I asked for. She did the best that she could, and I recognize that. And I can tell you that at the end of the night, while we were taking care of this incredibly sick and actually young patient, they were still alive, but she was, there was just nothing left in her tank. And I could tell as I was praising her efforts, because that's really what we're doing. We're praising the effort, not the outcome. You know, she started to get a little weepy. And I knew that she couldn't talk. If she were to talk, she would have just bawled right there in the unit. And she understood the importance of composure. And so I backed off, and I just, you know, kind of said thank you, made sure she was okay. And, you know, did my short, you're awesome. If you need anything, you know, I'm available. I got to go, you know, do something. Right. And then I went to the charge nurse, and I said, please go back and check on her. She needs your help. We can't have her quit, because again, there are quitters. There's plenty of quitters.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, you know. But she went back and she checked in on her. And to those folks who, you know, and I said quitters, to those folks who just can't handle it, I think that's good. That they walk away. We do not need a dysfunctional person, and I think we need to identify those people quickly. Because the last thing you need is somebody who in a crisis can't perform to, you know, to some level. And it's not that they should walk away in shame. It's just that, you know, we found that they're not best for this team. There's probably somewhere where they can excel, but this is not the place or the time.
Right. But I mean, you know, where you are working right now, you know,
yeah,
you receive a new person, or you come on a shift and you have a team, and it is what it is. You know, how, I guess, because it's one thing to be resilient for a code. Okay, let's say it lasts 30 minutes. It was really tough. It sucked. We made a lot of decisions, and then it ended. Good or bad, it ended. It's another thing to just have code after code and patient after patient, and resources are going down. You're getting stuff occasionally. Things are running out. You're having to switch. But this just constant grind. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So somebody, at some point, somebody's, you're going to break. Even though you are the right person, you're going to break. I guess, how do you organize the shifts of people? Because somebody, like, everybody just has a bad day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So how do you say, like, okay, this person, they're kind of just saturated. They're not doing their best that I know that they can do. You know, how do you switch them out? Do you handle that?
Yeah, I don't know that we've actually figured that out for the physician side. Here's kind of what I'm curious about. In some ways, and this is very harsh and this is very cruel. This is an opinion in my observation, but in some ways, you're playing with house money.
Uh-huh.
And that's the cruel part of it. You're getting folks from different institutions who are answering the call to service. They go there and they may or may not be invested in the community. They are there for one shift, or maybe they're there for a dozen shifts. Maybe they're there for more. I don't know. And I don't know that I don't know that everybody is, has an emotional tie to their patients or the community. These patients, you know, may die. You may lose two or three or four or five a night.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting better. So as far as the physicians, I can't speak to that because I haven't seen that element of burnout in this yet.
Right.
I think some of us, may have composure. Some of us understand the compartmentalization and that in these 12-hour shifts, they've got 12 hours to go to their room, go home or get in their car and have a moment. Myself, I had a 4.5-hour drive home and it went by pretty quickly. You know, I replayed some of the folks that we lost and, you know, how I could have conducted the resuscitations differently. And although I think with this COVID, it's just the folks that die, they die very, very rapidly. We don't have a lot of people who are lingering. We probably have half a dozen patients who are still on the ventilator. And they've been on the ventilator for, 2 weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that many. There are patients who get sick and get better over a period of days. We've transferred two patients in the past, 3 weeks or so. So we're really not transferring patients out. They're either getting better or they're dying. Very few are kind of decaying. And there are a couple patients that we wish they had a better run. The families are still pushing for a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And those are hard.
Right.
I mean, patients who are just sloughing and dying are just it's hard. That's what's hard on the staff. The folks that come in and die pretty rapidly, it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that they're not the ones that I think are making people suffer.
Right. Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. Just having not having lots of time to get attached to a patient.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I talked to families, one of the things, there's a few things that I say to try and help them through it. Number one is you're not sentencing them to life and you're not sentencing them to death. You may have had a conversation with your family member in the past and they said, oh, I remember Uncle Bob who's on that breathing machine. Don't ever do that to me. Or maybe they said, hey, if I'm ever like Uncle Bob, you fight for me and make sure they do everything I can. And then, it's their job to share that information. We talk about doing things for the patient and doing things to the patient. At some point, sometimes we just do things to the patient, but it's not going to change the outcome. And I try and help them through that thought process.
Right.
I think there's wrongful life. I think there's wrongful death. Mm-hmm. And sometimes doing some of these things to the patient is, in my eyes, isn't the right thing to do. But I try not to pass my value system to a family member who may not see things the same way until many of us agree it's futile. There are centers who during this crisis have said, you know, if two physicians agree it's futile, they have the ability to remove them from all types of life support. I don't know how often that's practiced. I don't know the circumstances. I haven't seen it happen. It's been discussed a number of times for some patients. Mm. This crisis has brought that to a head, and because it's a teleological decision, right?
Right.
There's many people that we can save, and there's people that we're not saving because this one patient who's been here for, you know, days to weeks is really sucking up the resources.
Right.
For a really a dismal outcome.
Mm-hmm. So having going through this experience, what do you hope our medical system learns from this? Hopefully it ends very soon, but I mean, there's always going to be a something, either a natural disaster, a pandemic, a whatever. What do you hope the medical system learns and changes going forward?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of things from the political standpoint that could be done differently, and I'm going to let the pundits work on that. But I do think that the team composition is super important. I think that identifying those who can work as a team and have experience under these types of conditions are very beneficial. I think this whole rationing, there's probably something to say about a more formal rationing process, whether it's ventilators or dialysis machines or transferring folks. I think those are really, you know, the top three. I mean, you can write a long list and nothing will get done, but I think if you have a top three, I think those would, and you just work on those three for the next thing, because I think we're going to see something like this again soon.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, experience. Other than the experience you're getting right now, there's obviously new people constantly coming up and moving forward. Do you think that you can get experience through training, like through your residencies, your internships? Do you think being exposed to difficult situations, or whether it be difficult patients or resource limited situations, do you think there's any benefit to that?
I think there's all kinds of benefit to that, Dennis. I think, you know, this military-civilian collaboration has so many opportunities. And although the civilian world can impart certain techniques and ideas, the military can teach the civilian world an enormous amount, and I certainly have benefited from my experience working with the special forces and the NSW and so forth, MARSOC, and if you listen and pay attention, you can't help but learn. And I think we should take that training to our trainees, residents and fellows, surgery and non-surgical. I think everybody can benefit from that. You know, the stress is the stress. We all perceive it differently. But how do you deal with it? And you know, how do you recognize it in others? And how do you develop that winning team is so important. And you know, I've learned a lot. I've made plenty of mistakes. I'd like to think that I've learned from those. And you know, some of them are obvious, and some of them are not so obvious. And this is just one of those opportunities where the lessons that I've learned have allowed me to, I think, make a difference. And at least that's the feedback I'm getting. And what is a good experience comes from bad. Good decisions come from bad experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think this is just been a great opportunity for me, and I think smarter people than me could have done a great job as well.
Oh, I mean, that's a given, right?
I love you. You're so good to me.
No. But no, I definitely, I hope that the collaboration between the civilian and military definitely moves forward, especially with, I know SOMC, they have a group of guys in New York, but one of the field hospitals out there.
Yeah.
But I hope that's an instance that will kind of propagate through the country as this thing, as it progresses and New York tamps down and somewhere else, either it's Detroit or New Orleans or wherever the next hotspot is. I hope this is something that continues and that, you know, the entire country sees some kind of benefit. I know the military is going to benefit from it. One, through experience. Two, through just talking to somebody who does this all the time or treats patients all the time. I think it's going to do nothing but help and elevate everybody.
Dennis, it is so glaringly obvious that I hope people pay attention. So what we're seeing, because there are no elective surgeries going on right now, those of us who are not just trauma trained, but board certified in surgical critical care, there's a whole bunch of us surgeons doing critical care call. Hmm. And of those, some of them have military experience. And that's kind of one of the, it's kind of one of the nods that you get when you're working with another person who understands a little bit or a lot about the military. We work as a team so much more easily. So even though, you know, as a civilian, I'm largely what, treated or accepted because mm-hmm. of the years I've spent with you guys. And that kind of mentality works so much better. So when there is a guy, you know, I'm working right now with a wonderful guy who, you know, was a Force Recon guy and ended up going to medical school, and now he's a surgical intensivist. And when we're on together and we're covering, because we had, 47 basic 47 ICU patients together. And we had to cover each other. And even though our roles were kind of distinct as who's covering what floor and what patients, mm-hmm. We took care of each other's patients for nights on end. And we never stepped on each other's toes. If he was running a code, I would support him. If I was running a code, he would support me. And many times we were running codes on each other's patients. And there was never this kind of like territorial behavior that I've seen in the civilian world where it's my patient, I'm running it. It's just, how do we get this patient through it? How do we get our nurses through it? Who's going to call the family? How do we get our residents through it? And then how do we, you know, deal with the situation after? And folks who had the good experience of being in the military, I think, get that team concept. There's many folks who have never been on a team, or if they were, they were on a dysfunctional team. They don't quite understand what it is to be on that team. It's you know, surgery is kind of a, in many ways, an independent type practice. Trauma is probably the biggest kind of team element of surgery. But even at that, I've seen, you know, individuals put themselves and their reputations higher than the team concept. And this is really, there's just not a lot of room for that in a crisis. And, and my guess is you and your listeners understand that and would be hugely important in a crisis like this.
Yeah. You know, hopefully not soon with another pandemic,
right,
where we're going to have benefit for this, but I definitely hope that there'll be a very lengthy lessons learned kind of review on how we could do this better going forward, because it's inevitable something will happen, either local or national, that's going to put a medical system to the test. So hopefully we can learn from this.
One of the big things that I learned, and I shouldn't say I learned, because I knew this and I tried to anticipate it, but it still was a lesson learned, is communication.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I'm going to share with you an experience I had. I sent you this information previously, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But we ran out of chest tubes. Right. You run out of all kinds of things during this crisis. Some are used well, some are not used well, but you run out of things quickly. And the hospital ran out, well, I was told the hospital ran out of chest tubes. But a patient with a tension pneumothorax, and although they had a IJ on that side, they didn't develop this tension until, or at least it wasn't identified for 24 hours later. And a chest x-ray that morning did not show it. So I put in an ET tube and I inflated the balloon and so forth. Patient did well, and everybody was kind of like amazed at this procedure and adaption of what you know, normally would be a chest tube. So seeing their reaction, I tried to make sure that everybody understood that this works, there's nothing wrong with it, nothing has to change. The chest x-ray shows the lung inflated. At the sign out, I did the same thing. I let the residents know, I let the attending know. And then the next, so I went, you know, I went back to back home, whatever, came back, and lo and behold, I saw a surgery resident in there putting in a chest tube where, on the same side of the chest, and there's no more ET tube. And I said, what's going on? And the surgery resident said, they asked me to change the tube. And I said, oh, why? And he said, well, it was a endotracheal tube. And I said, I know, I put it in there. It was working. What changed? What happened? And he said, I don't know, I was just told to do it. And I said, okay. And they tell you why. And he said, I'm an intern. I just, I was like, okay, fair enough. You know, just so you know that, you know, these things work. And if you were to tell me that something, you know, went wrong or something like that, I think that's great. I think, you know, something I could learn.
Yeah.
We don't do this routinely. But so far, everything I see and saw, you know, said that the ET tube was working, and maybe it was the comfort level of somebody looking at a ET tube instead of a chest tube. I don't know, but to this day, I still don't know why he had to change it. I think they did it because they were just used to looking at chest tubes.
Yeah.
So you can communicate, you can plan, you can do all as much as you want, and there still will be folks who feel like they need to see common things in these patients. And I think, you know, like I said, the communication and education with each novelty or adaptation to what we're normally used to is really important.
Mm-hmm. It is. Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis. It's always a pleasure to work with you guys.
All right. All right. Have a good one.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Great boy is waiting there for you.